this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. We need to remind you of the views that are expressed here, and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. The views of our guest, and, well, this afternoon, why we have, or I should say this evening, we have with us Judith McGrary, and we're going to be talking about what's happening as far as our farmers are concerned, and the most incredible legislation you've ever heard of. In fact, it's really not legislation. It's a bureaucratic edict put out by those faceless bureaucrats who really run our country. We have a lot of people back in Washington, D.C., or our elected representatives, but it's the bureaucracy that makes the rules and laws and interprets them. And the bureaucracy has determined that by the beginning of the year 2008, every farm animal in America is going to have to be chipped. They're going to have a chip, an identification chip in them, because after all, how are we going to stop the mad cow disease? How are we going to stop the spinach epidemic or the lettuce epidemic? And so somehow or other, if we're going to start putting chips into animals, we're going to be able to stop mad cow disease in America. Well, with that as a background, Judith McGrary, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am an attorney and a small farmer, both, in Austin, Texas. And I was going along my own merry way, like a lot of small farmers, focused on, you know, what I was doing day-to-day on our farm when I learned about this program. And at first I thought it was an internet rumor, and could it possibly be true? But then the Texas Animal Health Commission actually proposed regulations. As you were saying, it's the agencies running everything. And I started looking into it and realizing what was going on, and got mad. And so I've been fighting it ever since.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us just what is going to happen and what these regulations will entail and what impact it will have on the farmers?
There are a lot of unknowns. What's happened is the U.S. Department of Agriculture set up a sort of broad plan where everyone who owns even one livestock animal, and that's, you know, grandma with a couple of chickens in her backyard even, would have to register their property with the government, individually ID each animal, and then report movements to the to a database, not necessarily a government database, but a database, within 24 hours. And they want everybody enrolled into this program by January of 2009. And they're paying the states to do it. Basically, our federal tax dollars are getting funneled back to the states as, you know, basically bribes to put this program into place.
Well, now, what is the justification for it? I mean, why are they want to have chips in a couple of little chickens?
Well, what they say is that they need 48-hour traceback of all animal movements in order to address disease. And that sounds good on the surface. I mean, if you just hear that, people sort of nod their heads and go, well, yeah. But first of all, we've got traceback mechanisms. I mean, they kind of pretend that there's no existing means out there already for tracing animals. And that's just not true. And it also doesn't make sense when you start thinking about it, because it depends what kind of disease, what's the species of animal, how is the disease spread. There are all these questions that in many cases this type of traceback will be useless.
Well, now, of course, but this becomes a federal offense, or is this a state offense if you don't go along with it?
It will probably be a state offense, because what they've done is USDA's, they're doing the sort of let's make sure we can't take the blame. And so USDA hasn't promulgated federal regulations.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Judith McGrary and Gary, and we're talking about the program for chipping animals across America. And so we're wanted to get this right from somebody who's really studying this. Judith has been looking into this, and she says that this will not be then a federal program, although it'll be funded by the feds, but it'll be a state program. Now, we've heard that there's going to be a $1,000 fine for not going along with that. Is that accurate, or is that simply an urban legend?
Well, that's what we've seen in states that have already implemented it. So in Wisconsin and Indiana, the state adopted regulations making premises registration mandatory, and there were fines of $1,000 and loss of business license and things like that. In Texas here, they proposed regulations, and the proposed regulations would have allowed for fines up to $1,000 per day and even criminal misdemeanor penalties. So this is not something that they're taking lightly.
In other words, criminal offenses because you don't register your chickens.
Exactly.
Now, what about the food? We've heard that you have to register your food and things like that, where you keep the grain and things like that for the chickens. Is that a part of this federal program?
It's a separate federal program.
The
Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, was ordered in the 2002 Bioterrorism Act to provide for registration of all food processing facilities. Now, they wrote the regulations in a hurry, and to be blunt, they're not very well written, but I talked with the director in charge of that program, and they're working on clarifying that if you're selling direct from the farm, you are exempt. But if you own, like, a small business, you're under those regulations.
No, but this is regulation for registering where you have your grain and things like that. Is that it?
Yes, it's registering anywhere that food for either animals or people is stored or processed. They're very, very broad.
Well, wait a minute now. But food for people, what are they talking about?
Any type of food for people. For instance, if you run a business, if you've got a business where you buy some lettuce from farmers. You buy produce from farmers, and at your place you chop it up and turn it into mixed salads. You'd have to register with the FDA. But the farmer doesn't have to. They do have an exemption for farms.
All right, fine. So that basically, of course, then the food processors, every food processor will have to be registered with the government, and then, of course, do they have to report every package that goes out, or what do they actually report, or just the fact that they're doing it?
It's just a pure registering that you do it.
All right. That's
my understanding of that program.
All right, hold on. We'll be back in just a moment with Judith McGeary. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Judith McGeary, and we're talking about this incredible legislation that's coming up that's called chicken shipping. Well, anyway, it's really called... Does it have some sort of a fancy name?
It's the National Animal Identification System, or NAIS.
All right, National Animal Farm Identification.
No, it's National Animal Identification System.
Okay, give me one more time.
National Animal Identification System,
all right,
NAIS.
NAIS, National Animal Identification System. Now, what is the rationale for this? In other words, are they really worried about mad cow disease, or is that simply a vehicle that they're using to justify what I think is really red draconian legislation?
It's very much the latter. The big industry, the big sort of corporate agriculture, started developing this program back in the 1980s. It has nothing to do with mad cow disease or avian flu or 9/11. It is about the export market, and it's about creating a globalized food supply.
But how is this going to help to create a globalized food supply? In other words, we know that, for instance, when we had the mad cow scare disease, some of the people who were exporting to Japan wanted to test every cow for mad cow disease. The government wouldn't let them test their own cows for mad cow disease so they could safely ship them off to Japan. So it doesn't seem to me that they're really interested so much in preventing disease or certainly making people throughout the world feel secure about getting our products.
That's very correct. And what this is about is the idea that if they can set up a system, the big corporate agriculture are trying to implement this kind of a system in every country. Because once you have every country doing the same system, you can say, look, you've got no right to keep out our products. We're using the same system you are. They want everything the same. But at the same time, they don't want anything that provides real protection. I mean, they don't want to do something that might expose that the food supply isn't safe. So instead of doing testing, which actually would show whether the food was safe or not safe, you stick a tag in a cow's ear, and you say, look, we can trace it, which does nothing in real health terms, but it provides a really good marketing ploy.
Now, I will tell, what about this idea of chipping chickens? You know, I certainly, there's not that much of a profit in chickens. And if you've got to take it to the veterinarian and get a chip put in, that gets to be pretty expensive. Who's going to pay for the veterinary fees for the chips and all of this, these things? And for the veterinarian to come out to your farm and do this?
Well, to clarify, for chickens, they're not talking about microchipping.
That's all right. What are they talking about then?
Well, that's a really good question. I've asked that, and they go, well, you can put a leg band. Well, no chicken's leg is big enough to have a 15-digit number wrapped around it. The explanation that, scarily enough, makes the most sense is piercing the chicken's neck and having a tag hanging off the side of it, which anyone who's ever raised chickens and actually watched them and, you know, run around naturally realizes is a death warrant, because they'll peck each other to death. What this really is about, for instance, in poultry, is this is all designed for the big commercial poultry operators, because they'll be able to have one group ID number. So they'll stick 10,000 chickens into a confinement building, and they'll have just a group ID on the outside. Very cheap, very simple, very easy for them. The small farmer is going to get stuck trying to figure out some way to tag each and every chicken, which, even if you're not using electronics, I mean, even if you use a non-microchip method of ID, when you do it for every single chicken, it's still going to be extremely expensive and extremely time-consuming.
Well, how about just have a yard and you say, this is my chicken yard, and I got one number for all these chickens in the chicken yard?
Oh, but that will only work if all of those chickens are being handled from birth to death together and never commingled with other animals. So if you got a few chickens from, you know, the local feed store one year, and then you wanted to add a couple more chickens the next year, you just lost your right to do a group ID. So the way most small farmers or most individual animal owners manage their chickens, you can't do group ID the way they're writing this plan. It's designed for the commercial folks.
Well, of course, as anybody's then suggested, that it be utilized for the commercials people and not for the small farmer. Who's a small farmer? You know, most small farmers are not, they're not butchering their chickens and selling them in the markets, and that really is, you can't compete with the big farmers that way.
Absolutely, and we've tried making the point to the agency bureaucrats that this should not be applied to the small guy, and the response has been that the small farmer actually poses a, you know, serious disease threat to the large folks, which is nonsense. And when you look at the agency's own documents and own studies and records of outbreaks, consistently the bigger disease threat comes from the large facilities. But what the small facilities are, what, you know, our backyard poultry are, is they're a bit of a nuisance for the bureaucrats. They can't account for every chicken around. It messes up their paperwork. And so, actually, I think they'd very much like to see all the backyard poultry go away.
Why don't they just go ahead and say, well, unless you got more than 100 chickens, we're not going to worry about it because it's not worthwhile.
I think that would be very sensible, but they just refuse to.
Right. So it's one of these things that nothing really makes sense. Don't bother me with the facts that this is the way we're going to do it.
Exactly.
All right. Well, then, of course, this is going to have to be implemented by 2009, you see. We have two states that have taken on already. What about the rest of the states?
It's a patchwork quilt. There are several states that are sort of trying to get it implemented, and we've got grassroots opposition that are pushing back. Michigan actually jumped ahead and went straight to animal identification. As of next March, in 4 months from now, 5 months from now, you will not be allowed to move a cow anywhere in Michigan unless you have a radio frequency ID device in its ear.
All right, so it doesn't have to be injected, then they can put it on the ear? Or
on the ear tag, yeah. They're talking about putting it in the ear tag for cattle.
What about on horses?
Horses will be injected as a microchip into the neck.
Why inject the horse and not the cow?
Basically, I think they started with the idea of ear tags, and horse owners, myself included, ear tags on horses are just not an option, you know. They're very pretty horses, and they've got very pretty heads and very pretty ears, and having a tag hanging off them would ruin that. So they went to, injectable microchips for the horses.
So every horse is going to have to be microchipped?
Yes.
Now, we have heard, of course, that they're going to have a requirement that if you move your horse off your farm, you're going to have to notify the government.
Well, and what's going on now is they started off with the Equine Species Working Group recommending that any time a horse was commingled with any other livestock, so if you took a trail ride with your neighbor, you'd have to file a report within 24 hours. Now, there was all kinds of complaints about this. You know, the horse community was basically ready to take up arms and revolt. And so the Equine Species Working Group went, we didn't really mean that. Foolish us. So sorry. And they pulled back the recommendations. But when you sit down and you talk to the folks, the people who are actually writing these recommendations, and you push them a little, the response is, well, they can always change back. And ultimately, we do want reportable. We do want people reporting these events. But for right now, you won't have to. So basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to get everyone to calm down so that they can get the first two stages of the program through, and then they'll worry about the reporting.
Well, what if you're going to take your farm to your horse to a race? You're going to race your horse. Do you have to report that?
Ultimately, you will.
So everything is going to have to eventually be regulated and reported to Big Brother, then.
Yes, that is the full plan.
And, of course, as you move your cattle from one field to another, why, you're going to have that reported as well?
As long as it is on your own property, no. But, for instance, a lot of us, myself included, have grazing agreements with neighbors. You know, my neighbors, we graze their cows on our property for a while, and then we move the whole lot of them over to my neighbor's property. That will have to be reported.
And then what are they going to do? Are they going to be watching them by satellite? Is that it?
The original plan doesn't call for satellite tracking. The microchips and radio frequency ID devices that they're talking about are what's called passive ID, which means they can only be scanned from a couple of feet away. Now, a lot of folks have already pointed out that that's really not realistic because it's awfully hard to get livestock to travel calmly where you can scan them within a foot or two. And so there is a push and a lot of reason to think that ultimately this will move to active chips which could be scanned from a much greater distance.
All right, and of course we get into goats and sheep and all these things, and I suppose they'll all have to have an injectable chip?
They're trying to decide what to do with goats and sheep. They haven't said what type of tag would be required. But one thing to keep in mind when they say, well, maybe it won't be electronic, is think about the fact that each animal will have to have a 15-digit ID number, and you'll have to report every time it goes to a sales barn, every time it's moved to another property, all of these things. Can you imagine the errors that would be created if it weren't electronic? If people were sitting there writing down 15-digit ID numbers and then typing them into computers. It almost has to be electronic for this kind of incredibly detailed system that they've come up with.
But, I mean, how could this possibly be done? In other words, somebody's going to have to put this into a report and turn it into the government, and then every time the animal is moved, they're going to have to send another report. I mean, you may send it in over the Internet, but it's still going to have to go into the computer.
Yes. I mean, it boggles the mind how many places there can be errors and technological problems with this.
And we know how efficient the government is. In fact, last night, Jay Leno told the story. He went to the door, and a little boy comes and says, "Trick or treat," and Jay Leno says, "Look, Halloween was two nights ago." And the little boy says, "Yeah, but I'm from FEMA."
Oh.
We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest is Judith McGeary, and we're talking about another amazing government program, which probably will work almost even better than FEMA does, and the Office of Homeland Security, and guarding us from the wicked terrorists, and certainly far better, almost as well as the CIA that guarded America on the morning of September 11th. Well, anyway, of course, as we get into this thing further and further, you mentioned that the federal government is going to pay the states to do this, but who's going to pay the veterinarian? Who's going? Because especially if we're talking about chipping, the horses and some of the other animals. So who is going to pay for injecting the chips? Or can the farmers inject them themselves? Then who's going to pay for the chips? Who's going to pay for the scanners for scanning the animals?
Well, that's one of the wonderful questions that we keep asking. The answer appears to be a mix. A best answer right now is that the farmers will get to pay for the tags. The farmers will get to pay for whatever means is necessary to get the animal's tag, whether it's paying for labor yourself, whether it's getting a veterinarian to come out, whatever it is, that'll be on the farmer's bill. The scanners and the reports, they're trying to figure out ways to sort of not make it as obvious. So, for instance, we've been told by some industry folks who are running one of the databases that they're going to get fees put on sales barns and slaughterhouses to fund the databases. And the guy actually had the chutzpah to look me in the eye and say, and that way the farmer won't pay for it. And I just about busted out laughing because I have yet to see a fee imposed on a sales barn or a slaughterhouse that the farmer didn't end up paying for.
Well, now, what are they going to do with all this information when they have it?
They are going to create massive databases. They claim that they won't do anything with it unless there's actually a disease outbreak.
And what sort of diseases are they looking for?
What they call it is foreign animal diseases or emerging diseases.
And so what is a foreign animal disease? What is an emerging disease?
Not completely clear. Foreign animal diseases are things that are not currently within our borders. Emerging diseases...
Like foot and mouth disease?
Like foot and mouth disease. Emerging diseases are diseases that are within our borders but not in a high level, basically. But it's not clear. A lot of these diseases that they seem to be worried about are issues of economics, not really as much animal health. So, for instance, animal survival. Foot and mouth disease. There's a vaccine for it. And many animals will recover from it. It's not necessarily fatal. And it's certainly not a human health threat. But it's got huge consequences for the export market. So it's a massive issue for the big, huge companies who rely on their income to come from the export market.
Well, now, of course, are most of the animals actually vaccinated for hoof and mouth disease today or not?
No, we are not allowed to use the vaccine. If I've got sheep and I'm not allowed to get the vaccine to vaccinate them with.
Why not?
Because it will affect the export market. If there are animals that have antibodies because of the vaccine, there are export restrictions. So we are prevented from protecting our animals in the name of profits for large corporations.
I see. Well, that's, of course, everything. Of course, I'm sure there's always a logical explanation, but not necessarily something that really makes sense. And that's where we are today. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Judith McGeary, and Gary and Judith is a small farmer who's really very concerned about this new legislation that is coming down the line that is going to require animal identification. All animals. All farm animals are going to have to be identified. And now, of course, how many states have actually gone through with this so far? And how many states are you making progress in and blocking it?
Well, every state actually has implemented a, quote, voluntary program. And some of them are being fairly laid back about it. Others are being fairly aggressive, even though it's supposed to be voluntary. So, for instance, in Texas, where it's still voluntary, we had people lied to and told it was mandatory. Or in Oklahoma, where people were told that if they wanted to participate in the state fair, they had to microchip their goats. Or states where they've been told... Well, it's voluntary, but you were already in the Scrapie program, so we just rolled your information into it. And they get formed of this after the fact. So this is every single state, some level of this program is going on. We've made a lot of progress in a lot of states, though, trying to beat it back. So in Texas, they were prepared to make it mandatory. We had regulations proposed that would have made it mandatory, and we got them to drop the regulations. Vermont has put the program on hold. Massachusetts has stopped handing data over to the federal government. Tennessee, there was legislation introduced in the last session that would have blocked the program, and the representative who introduced it has committed to reintroducing it in the next session. So we're making progress in a lot of states on getting legislators to pay attention to this issue and start trying to put in measures to protect against the abuses that have been going on.
Now, of course, is the federal government giving a lot of our tax money to the states to implement this? In other words, are they effectively bribing the states? Is that how it goes?
It depends on which state and what your perspective. The USDA has spent approximately $84 million over the last 3 years. And how much has gone to which state seems to vary a lot. Louisiana, for instance, I was talking there last night, they've only gotten $177,000. But Texas got $1.3 million last year. So they seem to be focusing their efforts on a few states and then handing smaller amounts out to the others.
Well, of course, Texas has some very powerful friends in the White House. And so maybe that's why they get more money. Under any circumstances, the federal government gives money to the states, but what is the state's incentive, you know? Certainly for $150,000, you certainly couldn't implement a program like that. You're going to be losing money because you have to pay for the bureaucracy that does all of this.
Yes, and that's something I've tried pointing out to them. There are a couple of things. One is that this program will make the state bureaucrats' jobs easier because there's been... Overall, there's been this huge emphasis on disease eradication, and because of that, and biologically, it's impossible. There's no such thing as disease eradication when you've got wild animals that harbor the diseases. It can't happen. But we create a myth that it can happen, and we place sort of restrictions on state movements between states until you've, quote, eradicated diseases. And part of the process is being able to locate every single animal and prove that you've tested them. So the state bureaucrats have this incentive that their jobs will be made much, much easier if this program goes through.
They're going to test the animals. What are you going to test them for? You're going to test them for mad cow disease? They're not going to let them test every cow for mad cow disease? No way.
Oh, no, and the thing is they aren't going to do any preventative testing. But, for instance, use an example, an avian flu, because avian flu goes through this country every year.
Sure.
And there was an outbreak in Texas last year, and our state vet complains bitterly that it took him weeks to find all of the backyard flocks and prove that they didn't have avian flu. Well, the reality was none of them had it. They were all healthy. There was no animal health problem, but there was a bureaucrat problem. So this is something that makes the state vets be able to sort of check off the requirements.
In other words, they can say, yes, we know that there are 23,000 blackyard flocks of chickens, but then unless you check all those flocks of chickens, you don't know whether the disease is there or not.
Exactly. But I think part of them, they're hoping also that they'll just reduce the numbers. They can get rid of a lot of these pesky little small producers.
But aren't they concerned about the right of the people to be free and to have animals and do with their property as, you know, we're guaranteed under the Constitution?
Oh, that idea doesn't seem to even occur to them. I had a USDA vet yelling at me the other day, basically along the lines of, well, why would anyone object to registering with the government? Good reason could you have?
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Judith McGeary, and we're talking about this wonderful system of animal identification that certainly is being foisted upon the states. And, you know, the thing is that what's really so amazing, Judith, is I haven't even heard about this until about 2 weeks ago, and I'm sure you probably have been aware of it for some time, but we're certainly not hearing about it through regular channels.
No, we're not. And actually, even though, you know, I've been aware of it since January, but when you start realizing that, you know, industry's been planning it for 20 years, and the USDA has been spending millions of dollars on it for 3 years now, and those of us who own animals are only now finding out about it, they've done a very good job of making sure that the people who are going to be affected didn't have a say in how it was developed.
Well, of course, this is what so much of what goes on today. Everything is in secrecy, and we do not want the common people to know, because the common people aren't intelligence like us, superior people, and we know what's best for them and going to make the country work more efficiently like they do in all nations with a centrally planned economy. And, of course, we know what happens in countries with centrally planned economies, and it almost appears that we have people in America today who really do not believe in individual freedom. They want everything regulated and regimented from the cradle to the grave. Now, are you getting a lot of help and support from farmers and from people, the small people in the agricultural business? We know that the big farmers, the corporations are on the other side, but what about the average person, the mom and pop, who are the backbone of this country?
When folks hear about this, I'd say 90 to 95% of them are absolutely against it. So we've been reaching out to people both through the Internet. We've been holding public meetings to try to reach people who don't have Internet access. And uniformly, people get angry. They think that this is an appalling program. They think it's an invasion and a violation of their rights. And they recognize it's not going to provide health benefits. I mean, these are people who are law-abiding, responsible people. And they want their animals to be healthy, and they work hard to keep their animals healthy, and they're willing to cooperate in programs that actually would make a difference. But they look at this and they say, "This will take away my rights." And so, yes, we've got a growing grassroots movement where people are really speaking up against this.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I would hope in more and more, and we'll do everything we can to help you get the information out. Maybe we can build, a tidal wave of opposition to what I believe is simply one more infringement upon the rights and the freedoms of the individual. But there are people who do not believe in freedom, and we'll be back in just a moment with Judith. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Judith McGeary, and she's talking about this plan for animal identification. And, she's only been working at this since January of this year, but this thing has been, in the works for 20 years or more, and certainly very, very much being implemented and early stages of implementation for 3 years, but they're trying to keep it secret, ladies and gentlemen, because they don't want the public to know. And so much of what the government does is in secret, because there are people there who dream a different dream, who march to a different dream, drumbeat, who, I believe, worship a different god. Well, anyway, do you have a web page or some way that people can get in touch with you and learn more about this program?
Yes. One of the best pages is libertyarc.net. That's a coalition that's dedicated to stopping this program.
That's Liberty
Ark, A-R-K.
Liberty Ark.
As in Noah's Ark.
All right.
.net.
All right.
So that's one web page. The other one for my nonprofit organization is www, that's the same for Liberty Ark, farmandranchfreedom.org. And for people who don't have Internet access, we have a toll-free number, and it's 866-687-6452.
Yeah, now you have to get these twice, because in radio you have to figure the people are not going to have their pen out.
They're not going to have their pen ready.
Let's get the 200 net sites and the telephone number one more time. And ladies and gentlemen, you get your pen and paper out. You better find out what this is about. Are they going to have you, certainly going ahead and chipping every little chicken, or at least putting some sort of a 15-digit tag on the leg of every little chicken, even if there's no room on the leg for that number, but you're required to do it because it doesn't matter whether it's logical or not. We're dealing with people who look at the world differently than we do, and everything is by the numbers, as it were. So let's get the sites out, then we'll give the telephone number, and I want to remind our listeners, our telephone number, if you'd like to call, you have a question or comment, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, so get the websites, get the telephone number out.
Okay, the websites are www.libertyark.net or www.farmandranchfreedom.org, and the toll-free number is 866-687-6452.
And that's libertyart.net, not com. Is that right?
Exactly, .net.
.net. Okay, fine. And, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience and you're as horrified at this as I am, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, because what they're doing of Sydney is bringing everybody who is involved with producing the meat, which, of course, is an essential part of our diet, you know, bringing them under the control of the federal government, at least of the state government. And believe me, of course, these databases are going to be available to the federal government. And really, this is a rather frightening thing. Why do they want to know where all the food is? I mean, this certainly has nothing to do with stopping disease. I mean, how many major epidemics do we have at the present time, or have we had in the last couple of years, among the livestock of our nation?
We've managed to contain disease outbreaks very effectively with our existing means. When we do have diseases, we do have occasional outbreaks, and they're contained very effectively. So there's no reason to think that we need this kind of a program.
All right, certainly we saw a couple of years ago over in Great Britain where they had a threat of a mad cow disease, and then they had a hoof and mouth disease, and they could have vaccinated the flocks. Instead, they killed tens of thousands of cattle when they could have stopped the whole thing with a vaccination program. Just didn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense, and what's scary is the USDA plans to follow that example. The USDA's plan, if foot and mouth disease were to come into this country, is to draw 10-kilometer kill zones and kill all of the animals, all the susceptible animals within that zone.
Well, now, who's going to pay, then, the farmers for that?
Well, theoretically, there'd be some government compensation, but, first of all, there's no guarantee that happens. And even if it does, simply paying, the per-pound value of that animal doesn't make the farmer whole. I mean, he's lost his livelihood. He's lost his ability to bring in income. A lot of farmers can't recover from it, and we saw that in England. We saw, I believe, 60 farmers committed suicide, directly attributable to what happened with the foot and mouth disease outbreak, because they couldn't recover. They were destroyed.
And, of course, the thing is, the logical thing would be just to use the vaccine, wouldn't it?
Yes. You use the vaccine, you do a strict quarantine, animals aren't allowed to move anywhere, you sort of lock everything down, you go through, you vaccinate, you test. There are rapid field tests, and you kill immediately any animal that's actually sick, and you work your way through that way. USDA refuses to use rapid field tests, which is the best way to prevent disease from spreading, because it'll tell you right then and there, is this animal sick?
And you have to ask yourself, why won't they do what's logical? I mean, you probably don't know, but I'm a physician, and certainly 20 years ago, I was on the front lines of the battle to try to stop the AIDS epidemic and to treat it like a public health a disease, and certainly to go ahead and do routine testing and try to stop the spread of the disease. And the government officials steadfastly, U.S. Public Health Service, CDC, NIH, all of them refused to do what was logical. 500,000 Americans are dead, another million and a half are infected, and now they're suddenly coming around and saying, hey, maybe we ought to do routine testing. We were talking about that 20 years ago. But they block that at every turn. And you have to ask yourself, why? Well, of course, I have my own opinions on that. The people who listen to our programs know very well what I believe. I think they know exactly what they're doing. But they appear to be like they're foolish, like they don't understand, like they're illogical. I think they're very, 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 very well informed. I think they know exactly what they're doing. My personal opinion is they just don't want you to know what they're doing. Well, our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question. If you think that there's something very strange about this massive program, and if there's a program that really well over 90% of the people who hear about it are against, why isn't Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or the New York Times or the Washington Post or Time or Newsweek or U.S. News, why aren't they mentioning this at all? Because this is going to have a profound economic impact on every small farmer in America, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the small farm, we're seeing a renaissance where people are moving back to the land. Farmers markets are springing up all over the country. People want to buy direct from local farmers. I mean, it's this incredible movement to revitalize the small farm in America, and this, frankly, will be, if not a complete death now, a severe blow to that. I mean, I think you're right. I think they know exactly what they're doing, and I think that's part of what's happening. They don't want a local foods movement. They don't want people buying directly from their farmers. They want large corporate-controlled food supply.
And I think you're absolutely right. Well, let's go to Will, who's calling us from Missouri. Hi, Will. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well, Dr. Stan and Judith. Good broadcast this evening on a very important topic. One thing for certain is that there is a vast population differential when we think about the people that will be actively impacted by this and the people who live in the urban areas, about a 97 or a 95-5 ratio. So this is an important issue. But when we think about the things that we can do in the country, I live in the country and have the little flock of chickens, and what we can do on the small side is to get this information into the hands of the local farmers and ranchers, because this is an issue that will finally wake them up. And we've had quite a bit of success with the petition drives here in southwest Missouri this past summer, and we've also been able to then, by demonstrating that we had quite a hot-button issue for the farming community, get the various candidates and representatives and senators interested enough in this issue that we are looking forward to legislative hearings. So there are things that we can do, but we must do it, and we must do it now. And I really commend you for having this broadcast on the air this evening.
Well, we're going to keep hitting this. We're going to get a couple of other people on here talking, maybe even put together a four tape set on it, because I think it's an important issue. How long have you been aware of this, Will, this problem?
Well, we've been working on this about a year here, but there in the Ozark Property Rights Congress, there are several people that are involved that are very influential. Ray Cuneo is one of them. But our group here has been working diligently all summer. We attended all of the fairs and the festivals and things, and we had our booth set up and circulated the petition. And as far as the rural folk going by, we would probably have 25 signatures on every 25 signatures to one no as they came by the booth. So it was an overwhelming support for the issue.
Well, why did some people say no? Were they farmers? Were they people who felt that this somehow wasn't going to affect them? Or were there people who felt that this was a real good idea? What we need is more bureaucracy tracking of those little chickens in people's backyard.
No, generally, Dr. Stan and Judith, the ones that didn't want to sign were people who worked for Farm Bureau, people who worked in the ag business, or the grain and the feed mills, people who work for Georges, Tyson, Swift, and the others. They would just go right on by because they know that this is a vote against their own livelihood. And it's just a shame that they don't think of the long term. They're just thinking of their pocketbook.
Well, I'll tell you what, freedom is one ball of wax. And when one group of people lose their freedom, eventually everybody loses their freedom. Anyway, well, God bless you for what you're doing. And please keep it up. We'll appreciate your calling.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Well, let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. Jack, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes. I want to ask Judith whether she is aware of whether the county in which she lives requires recording of the property deed.
Oh, you just as a general principle of recording of property deeds? I believe so.
Okay. Well, in every county, they're under these statutory edicts, and they cannot coerce you into recording your property deed. So when you check with the county treasurer, as I did, they must tell you there is no law requiring the recording of the property deed.
Okay, but what does that have to do with what we're talking about, Jack?
Well, okay, the government, remember, Dr. Stan, in the Constitution, it says, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Okay, unless you voluntarily acquiesce by registering your property, they do not have the legal, they're not the presumed valid holder in due course of the legal rights and interests. It's all about legal rights and interests. And since 1933, we've been under commercial trust law.
Okay, but in real practicality, Jack, from the point of view of the farmer out there, this is not something that they are really going to. Right now, we've got to do something to block this crazy legislation. And, of course, sometimes people actually want to get off on all of these ideas, you know, having to do with matters of law. But right now you have a bureaucracy that doesn't believe in the law, that wants to force people to do things. And now, this is ever, was this ever acted on by the legislature back in Washington, D.C.? This is coming from the federal government, subsidized by the federal government. But did our duly elected representatives ever vote on this sort of thing, Judith?
Not really. What they did is they adopted a statute in 2002 called the Animal Health Protection Act, which gave USDA very broad authority in a lot of areas, but it doesn't clearly authorize NACE. I mean, it's one of those things where you know very well, you know, how agencies will sort of leap on vague language and say, see, this is how we get our authority. But it's certainly far from clear. I mean, it's not a clear authorization by any means. And what they have done, unfortunately, what Congress has done is even though they haven't passed on the program, they do keep providing the money for it.
Well,
that's
they,
how we get into this mess.
But, of course, they give a blanket amount of money for agriculture, you know, and then, of course, they spend it the way they want to, or they, you know, whoever, heaven only knows what they do with the money. I mean, as long as the government has money, they're going to misuse it. This is why I vote against all of the government taxing bonds, and whenever the government wants more money, I restrict it, because they never spend it right. When it's your money, you spend it right. When it's the government's money, why, you're going to spend it any way you want to. You're going to give it to your friends. You're going to, I mean, it was like this, senator up in Alaska who wanted to build a quarter of a $600 billion bridge or something. It was known as the Bridge to Nowhere. I think it was 250, something like that. Anyway, there were 60 people on the island. They could have bought everybody on this island, you know, a jet plane for the cost that it was going to cost to get this bridge through. Well, eventually when this came to be known, why Congress did not authorize the money for the bridge. They just gave it to Alaska so Alaska could build the bridge. And it would be equivalent of about, $400,000 or $500,000 for every individual on the island. I mean, this is the sort of insanity that goes on. Government can never be trusted with money. And, of course, no man's life, property, or pocketbook are safe when the legislature's in session. Well, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question for Judith McGarry, and we're talking about this incredible program by which they want to actually go ahead and chip all the animals, or if not chip them, at least have some sort of identification mechanism so that every animal will have to be involved. Now, what about rabbits? What about geese? What about other animals of that sort? And what about ostriches and llamas? And are they all going to have to have these identification cards on them?
It covers pretty much everything. Llamas and alpacas, deer, elk and bison, guinea hens and turkeys and pigeons.
I mean, guinea hens?
Guinea hens. I actually have this vision of sitting on my front porch with a beer watching them try to tag my guinea hens.
Well, but they're not going to do it themselves.
I know.
They'll tell me
I have to, and they'll fine me for not doing it. But it's still the fun vision of imagining the bureaucrats trying to catch my guineas.
I know. Well, because the thing is, of course, it's funny, and yet, of course, if you really, these people are deadly serious. They really want to regulate and control everything in the world until people understand there really are people like that, and they exist in every authoritarian society. And that is, of course, why our founding fathers put limitations on on what government could do. And as Thomas Jefferson said so well, in matters of politics, speak not to be of competent men, but rather bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution. So they did. They limited the power of the federal government, but they've taken the chains off the government and off the bureaucrats, and now they're forging them for the people. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Judith McCreary, and wrap up this program right here at Radio Liberty. But remember her telephone number. It's 866-687-6452. That's 866-687-6452 at the website www.libertyarc.net. That's libertyarc.net, or Farm and Ranch Freedom. Farm and Ranch Freedom. We'll be right back. All right, well, you've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, just after your comments, one of the scenes that comes to mind that I think sums it up, the mentality that's pushing this through, is we had one official at a meeting say, anyone who doesn't want the government to know what they're doing with their animals is guilty. And just about everyone in the room stood up in just outrage and went, guilty of what? When did we lose our right to privacy?
What did the official say?
He wouldn't answer. He changed the topic afterwards.
That is the attitude of these fascists that we have. They really have this fascist mentality. If you don't do what we want, you are guilty.
Yes.
And it is an autocratic idea. There are people who really believe that they have the right to rule and to control. And of course, they want to control everything. And you are guilty if you object to it. And if they possibly could, they would destroy everybody. But there are just too many of us and so few of them.
And the key is making sure that it's clear that there are too many of us. I mean, our strength lies in working together. I mean, there's a lot of information on both of those websites that people can go, pull down sample letters, pull down petitions, sign up as supporters. I mean, what we need is people not just to sit in their rooms and say, I'm mad about this.
Who would we go to, say, in California or the other state to find out about this? Would you go to your state agricultural department? Who could tell us what's going on in California or Nevada or in Oregon or Washington State?
Well, if you want the official story, you go to the State Ag Department. On the Liberty Arc website, we've got state coordinators in about 20 or 25 states who've been researching what's going on in their state and sort of networking the opposition. So if you go to the libertyarc.net website, you can get connected with people who are against the program and who've already been trying to find out what's going on officially in their state.
And so there's no sense in reinventing the wheel. Let's go ahead and go to the LibertyArc.net website. LibertyArc.net website. And Judith, I hope we can get you onto some of our other networks. We actually have four different networks we do every day. And so I will give you a call, and I hope you'll come on some of the other programs with us.
I'll be glad to. Thank you so much for covering this issue.
Thank you for what you're doing and for caring enough about freedom to become involved in this battle, and I will sit back and think about the bureaucrats chasing your guinea hens, trying to put the marker on them. God bless. Thanks so much, Judith. Bye bye.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney, it's so important that you understand what these people are up to. They want to control us. There really are people with a fascist mentality. And where do you think a person with a fascist mentality would go to work? He'd go to work for government, of course. That's where you have the power. And unfortunately, there are always people in every society who want to control other people. Now, in a free society, they have to do it through a competitive process. In a authoritarian society, they do it by working for government. History records that people lose their freedom when they're not involved. All that's necessary for evil to triumph is good people do nothing, and the price good people pay for their apathy and indifference to public affairs is that they are ruled by evil men. The price that good people pay for their apathy and indifference to public affairs is that they are ruled by evil men. And ladies and gentlemen, if you listen to our programs, you know that there are evil men out there. And so we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to going to our website, getting our material. Read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Understand that this abstract of evil is not simply, or this idea of evil is not simply an abstract idea. It's a very real idea. There are people who belong to Luciferian and satanic organizations. There are satanic societies out here that are being covered by the government, like the one that David Berkovitz belonged to. Remember the David Berkovitz, the son of Sam Keller? He belonged to something called the Process Church of the Final Judgment. And, of course, Charles Manson was affiliated with that, as have many other people been. And you probably never heard of the Process Church of the Final Judgment because the media is not going to tell you, and the FBI is going to do everything they can to cover it up because many of these satanic organizations go right into the highest level of our government. And what is their goal and objective? To bring about a one-world government and a new world order, and along the way, of course, to destroy humanity as much as they can and to create diseases and regulate and regiment and... It's very difficult for people to understand anything could be like this, but it really is true. Read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Get the book which we carry, The Diary of a Devil Hunter. Listen to my four-tape set with Father Malachi Martin. It's called The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. Read his book. It's entitled Hostage to the Devil. That's Hostage to the Devil. And of course, get our four tape sets on the supernatural, on Satanism and deliverance. And of course, you want to see the videos we carry. They sold their souls for rock and roll. They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. I promise you, you will never look the world through the same eyes after seeing those videos. Certainly, you want to get Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2. The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and look at the items that are listed there. We have a new four-tape set on the changing church because the church has been infiltrated and, of course, is being taken over. And they have infiltrated our religious seminaries, Catholic, Protestant. Why do you think we have so much homosexuality and pedophilia among our priests? Because that's what they were taught in their Catholic seminaries. And if you haven't heard our interview with Malachi Martin, where he talks about the satanic ceremony in the basement of the Vatican. But believe me, it's in the Protestant church, it's in the Jewish church. You need to hear our interviews with Barry Shamish. You need to hear our new four-tape set, The Truth About the Holocaust, with an interview with Barry Shamish, who talks about the Sabbatean movement within the Jewish church. You need to get our four-tape set on the North American community. The Security and Prosperity Partnership, and of course the North American Highway that is being actually under construction, will begin construction the first of the year, owned by Spain, and of course taking away people's private property to build a private four-toll highway. You need to get our four-tape set on medical myths and what you need to know. You need to get our four-tape set on the impending police state. You need to get our material on concentration camps in America. We have a special on that, the concentration camp special. Understand that freedom is lost when good people aren't involved. At least check out the facts. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Our next hour is going to be open line because our guest canceled. We're looking forward. is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, our regularly scheduled guest, Tony Strickland, who's running from Comptroller, is not going to be here. We may have a guest calling in at the half hour who's running for Congress in the congressional district. But in the meantime, we're going to have open lines. If you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So if you have something you'd like to talk about, give me a call. I have absolutely nothing to talk about because I didn't know we weren't going to have a guest until just a couple of minutes ago. But let me sort of give you something that on my heart as we talk this evening. Today I had a young man call me, and he was, of course, is running for political office. And I asked him, well, you're running for a national office. What's your position on the war in Iraq? His idea was we should go ahead and put more funding and more troops over there and win the war and come out. Well, now, that's a fine way to look at it. But I'm old enough to remember Vietnam. And I used to say we ought to win the war in Vietnam and come out. But I didn't understand. We didn't go in to win the war, and we were not going to win the war because Henry Kissinger was in charge of that war. In fact, I was watching a DVD last night on the trial of Henry Kissinger, and it pointed out that the North Vietnamese were willing to end the war in 1968 on exactly the same terms they ended the war over 5 years later. With, of course, the majority of our boys killed during that five-year period. Henry Kissinger would not allow them to end the war. Certainly the Johnson administration was negotiating with the North Vietnamese so we could pull our troops out, and Henry Kissinger told Richard Nixon, who got hold of Claire Chennault's wife, who went to the president of South Vietnam and said, do not negotiate, do not make any agreements at all about ending the war with North Vietnam, and we will win this war as soon as we get in. Of course, they were never allowed to win the war. It was during the Nixon administration that we built the Kama River plant there so that we could, Russia, the largest, truck plant anywhere in the world, where they built the plant, the trucks that were then taken to Vietnam to carry the supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to kill our boys in South Vietnam. It was during the Nixon administration, of course, the administration before, when, of course, they were not allowed to bomb the power plants, the electric generating plants in North Vietnam. And, of course, if they'd bombed those, it would have ended the war. They would have had no electricity. Or bombed the dikes, which would have flooded North Vietnam and ended the war, or bombed the rail yards at Haiphong, or bombed the harbor at Haiphong, or mined the harbor at Haiphong. We never intended to win the war in Vietnam. You must understand it was a great diversion. We weren't financing communism. The United States funded communism from its inception in 1918, and the United States is still funding communism in both Russia and in communist China today. And all you need to do is look at this amazing thing that's happened in China, and you go to the major cities over there, and these massive skyscrapers everywhere. Did anybody ever ask where the money came from? American corporations, American banks, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Asian Development Bank, the Agency for International Development, all funded with your money, ladies and gentlemen, all funded with your money. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And as we've told you before, I had the opportunity to interview both William H. Sullivan, who was the American ambassador to Laos and had actually gone to Paris with Henry Kissinger to negotiate the peace settlement in 1973, and General, four-star Marine General Louis Walt, and both of them personally told me we could have won the war at any time within 2 months. All we had to do was allow our air power to be used on North Vietnam, invade North Vietnam, and that would have been the end of the war. But you have to understand, we never went into the war to win the war. We were told we were there because of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, but that was a lie. We were told, we were there because, of course, if we don't stop communism in Vietnam, they're going to take Laos and Cambodia and Malaysia and Australia and New Zealand, and then they're going to be in San Francisco. We have to stop communism. But nobody understands. We've been financing communism. Communism doesn't work. A centralized planning, a centrally planned economy fails, and Russia was always a failure and would have simply been destroyed and overthrown by its people in the 1920s had it not been constantly subsidized from America. And if you've never read the books by Professor Sutton, Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, they're three volumes, and you can probably get them at your local library, university library, or the books that we carry entitled Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, which is a summary of the material, and of course the interview I have with Professor Sutton, the video interview called The Best Enemy Money Could Buy. As you begin analyzing this, you realize we financed communism from its inception. In fact, if you read the book written by Zygmunt Brzezinski called Between Two Ages, America, the Technotronic Age. It was published in 1970. Remember, Zygmunt Brzezinski is the man who David Rockefeller picked to actually form the Trilateral Commission, which is an occult organization, probably the most powerful occult organization in the world. But Zygmunt Brzezinski, of course, writes in his book, and one of the footnotes about the fact, and he refers to Professor Sutton's work about the funding of communism, that America financed communism since its very inception. And if you've read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, I quote from other books written by people who were there back in Russia at the same time, in 1918, about how the American government was funding and American corporations, and a man named Raymond Robbins and the man named Thompson, they were actually funding the Soviets. They were very close to Lenin. And many of our American elitists really loved what was going on in Russia, because it was really had nothing to do with redistribution of wealth. It all had to do, basically, with a ruling elite who controls the common people. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Many years ago, there was a congressman from Georgia. His name was Larry McDonald. And Larry McDonald was not only a very effective conservative congressman, but he was also at one time the chairman of the John Birch Society. And he was going to try to use the organization to really do something about, awakening the American people and turning our country around. And then, of course, he went for a trip to Korea. And he was on flight 007 that was shot down. And, of course, many of us believe, and I think with good reason, and we actually have a four-tape set on flight 007 and books and secret reports that came out from the government on that, and they're all available to Radio Liberty. And I believe that the plane was shot down, and Larry McDonald and everybody on it were taken off the plane and sent to concentration camps and will have never been seen or heard from again. And there were actually people in Israel who were tracking the movements of the prisoners from 007, from Korean flight 007. What a terrible thing to contemplate. Our government knew about it. Why? They were working with the communists. Why? Well, because Larry McDonald had put together something called the Aid and Trade Documents, pointing out how all during the Vietnam War, the United States was funding the North Vietnamese, funding the Russians who were funding the North Vietnamese. But we couldn't let the American people know that. any more than today we can let the American people know that, for instance, the people who are aligned against Israel, and that is, of course, Hamas and Fatah, the two Palestinian groups, Hamas was created by the United States and Israel. It's covered in a book we carry called The Devil's Game, Robert Dreyfus, The Devil's Game. And then, of course, just today I was reading that we're sending money to Fatah, which is the other Palestinian group, and we're sending weapons to Fatah and rifles to Fatah. And what's the response? Why, of course, the people in Fatah says, we're going to use those weapons to go after Israel, to fight Israel with. So we're providing weapons and rifles to Fatah they're going to use against Israel, and then we're arming Israel so that they can take on Fatah. We finance both sides, and that's what we did in Vietnam, and that is what we are doing, in as far as Iraq today. I mean, who do you think is really funding all of this this massive movement and these militias? We find out that just within the last couple of weeks that both the Sunni and the Shia militias have been resupplied with large amounts of weapons. Where are the large supplies of weapons getting in there? We control the country. We've got air cover. If large supplies of weapons are going in, you would think we would know where they're coming from, wouldn't you? If you understand, we are not there to win. We are there to continue this war so we can justify staying there. It is a great diversion. And as our boys fight and bleed and suffer and die there in the sands of Iraq, we are losing our freedom here at home. And that's what Vietnam was really all about. In fact, they even bragged about that in their magazine, Foreign Affairs Magazine, the official theoretical journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. And you go back and you read their January 1967 issue, an article by McGeorge Bundy. And he lays it out very, very clearly that we're in Vietnam, not to win. And certainly the last thing we want to do is pull out. And as he said, it would be an act of folly for anybody to say that we have a choice between persistence in Vietnam and full budgetary support for our economic programs here at home, because exactly the opposite is the case. The road forward at home to the dimensions of health and education and welfare and true equality is not by leaving Vietnam. Exactly the opposite is the case. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam. And so our boys stayed in Vietnam, and they fought and they bled and suffered and died while we lost our freedom here at home. And that's exactly what's going on in Iraq today. And the sooner you realize that, the more effective you're going to be in this battle. Well, let's go to Patrick in Kentucky. Hi, Patrick. How are you doing?
Doing fine. I could barely hear you a while ago. I was on Rick Adams' show a while ago, and he was referring to Yahweh as Yahoo. And I meant to say, well, I thought that was a chocolate drink, and really what I meant to say was I thought that was a website. But anyway, your show comes on right after his show. But I heard you talking, and about these global elite, can't they print money out of thin air?
Sure, they've been doing it for years. They create money out of nothing. That's one of the most carefully kept secrets. And that's what fractional reserve banking is all about. And so they either print the money or they create the money. Now, remember, they do not print the money. The money is printed by the Treasury. But they can create money and bank deposits out of nothing.
Right. And I started seeing all this new money coming out around when Clinton was in office. Like around, the mid-90s, all this nice, crispy, clean money.
Well, I think what you have to really do is really understand the background of money. I have a little pamphlet. It's called The History of Money, and it explains to you how this works. And basically, people think that printing money, yes, printing money has an effect, but the major thing is if you go to the bank and you borrow $100,000, you don't get $100,000. You get an entry, and then you can write checks on it. You can take it out, but you don't take it out in actual in currency. Most of it's electronic transfers. And what they have done, of course, let's imagine you sell your house for $100,000. That house, that $100,000 is deposited in the bank. Based upon the fact that the bank has $100,000, now that they can lend out $1 million if they have and it's a fractional reserve system. In other words, if they have a 10% of the money there, then they can create the other 90% out of thin air, and that's exactly what they're doing. So that's how they create money out of nothing. And then they can lend out that $1 million, and people get that $1 million, and they'll deposit in the bank, and then the next bank can lend out $10 million. And it's a Ponzi scheme, and the average American has no idea. There's absolutely nothing behind this other than the value of the property that's there. In fact, everything is built upon debt. And, of course, as this goes on, why, of course, everything tends to go up in value, but eventually you get to the point, and that's where we are right now, where they're going to have to start contracting the money supply, and when they do, most people are going to lose their homes and their cars and their jobs. And you're going to see what happened, in America in the 1930s. You're going to see what happened in Russia in the 1990s. You're going to see what happened in Argentina 4 or 5 years ago, and when people lost their whole life savings. So anything else, Patrick?
I guess, how long does it take for property value to go up?
No, it doesn't take them very long. The property values have gone up. Now the property values are starting to go down. Because, of course, they created an artificial bubble, and they did that by making money readily available by encouraging people to take adjustable-rate mortgages where they could give a very, very low interest rate and very low monthly payments, with the idea that in a few years down the line they would adjust the monthly payments, and of course instead of paying $1,000 a month for this luxurious home you had that you couldn't afford, now you're going to have to pay $2,000 or $3,000 a month, and for the average individual they can't meet the payments, and the average individual then is going to lose their home. People think that homes are always going to go up in value, and they do during the inflationary spiral, but when you get to the top of the spiral, why, whatever goes up, it will come down. And house prices and values are going down all across America.
Well, it looks like they're going to, pull a rabbit out of a hat on Tuesday, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know they're going to pull a rabbit out of the hat. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. But I think even more, I think, something that if you're really watching what's happening, what you want to do is watch the price of gold and silver and platinum. Because they're like the canary in the mine shaft. They tell you what's really going on. And over the last week to 10 days, gold has gone up about $30 an ounce. Platinum has gone up $150 an ounce. Silver has gone up about $0.50 an ounce. But, of course, what this indicates is something big is going to happen monetarily. I don't know what it is, but the people who are really pulling the strings behind the scenes, are watching that canary, and they they know something big is about to happen.
Doctor, do you think that if the Democrats did happen to get in, which they're predicting, which could not happen, which may not happen because of the rogue tricks Tuesday, do you think if they got in and got us out of Iraq, do you think there's any chance they could get us in North Korea?
Yes, I do, but I don't think they're going to get us out of Iraq. I think that the leadership of both political parties are controlled by exactly the same people.
Absolutely.
And so when you understand that, why, of course, they're not going to get us out of Iraq, but they may well get us into North Korea. And, of course, they may very well get us into Iran. Right now, there are four major battle groups. There are hundreds of ships right off the shores of Iran today on military exercise in Iran. Three of our battle groups are there, and one battle group are the Boxers over in the Red Sea. That's four battle groups. We've only got seven or eight, and they're all concentrated right adjacent to Iran, threatening Iran. And I think that I don't know what's going to happen. I just hope and pray nothing happens. But I'm very, very fearful that these crazy people in Washington, D.C. are being manipulated into taking us to war with Iran and then with the whole Muslim world. Anything else you'd want to cover?
Thank you, Doctor.
All right.
God bless you.
God bless. We'll be back here in just a moment. We have open lines 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Watch the price of gold and silver. I mean, it's been down for some time, and suddenly it's come alive just in the last, as they say, the last week. And when you see platinum going up almost $150 an ounce within a matter of just a few days, something big is in the offing. When gold is up $30 an ounce within a week and a half, something big is in the offing. Anyway, hang on to your hat. We'll be back here in just a moment, and welcome your calls here That's Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're going to have open lines for this hour, and right now we have Eric calling us from Compton. Hi, Eric. How are you doing? Good to hear from you.
I'm fine, Doc. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
I got a comment, then a question. I used, in my conversations with people, I used to say that, talk about how Democrats for years, we're headed toward the one world government, regardless as to what party's in office, but I always would say the Democrats are getting us there faster. My analogy would be the Democrats were taking us there on the plane, and the Republicans would take us there on the bus. And then Bush got in office, and we go to war, and the pace accelerated even faster. So it just goes to show you, it really doesn't make a difference.
You're absolutely
who's in charge. And then the question, I'm a little confused about something about 9/11.
All right.
I have Alex Jones's Terror Storm. I've seen a part of the video, Loose Change. Now, the plane that hit the Pentagon, was that a passenger jet?
Well, you're speaking of the North Tower or the South Tower?
No, the one that hit the Pentagon.
Oh, I'm sorry. We don't know what hit the Pentagon. I mean, the thing is that...
They're saying it was a passenger plane.
Well, it's supposed to have been a passenger jet.
So were there passengers on there with people with names? Is there a passenger list?
Yeah, there's a passenger list. In fact, Barbara Olson was supposed to have been on that passenger plane. And we've heard all sorts of conflicting bits of testimony about that. There's some people who I have actually talked to two people who told me personally that they saw the plane come in low and hit the Pentagon. Now, one of them was a minister. One of them was just a fellow whose name was given to me. My friend Karen Lee Bixman talked to six people who claimed they saw the plane hit the building. Did they really see the plane hit the building? Were they lying? Did they say a hologram? In other words, you can actually simulate these things with holographic images. I don't know what actually happened. I do know one thing. I do know that the government immediately confiscated all of the video clips, all of the video footage that showed
right.
what happened. And under a Freedom of Information Act request from the Judicial Watch, they released one clip, and you can look at that, and you can't see anything on it. You cannot see a plane coming
in. No, there's no plane.
So basically what they've done is everything is a matter of confusion, and they're intensely trying to confuse people. Now, I talked to, immediately after 911, I talked to another person who was in a high-rise not too far away from the Pentagon, and they told me that the plane came in, it had American Airlines markings on it, and it looked, but it wasn't a regular, it looked like a commuter jet. In other words, much, much smaller than a regular passenger jet. So that was their story. Then, as I say, I've talked to two people who say they saw a major size passenger jet, and yet when I look at the hole in the Pentagon, I just don't believe that this major passenger jet went into that. Not only that it went there, but it went through two or three layers there of this reinforced concrete
right.
and came out on the other side and made the nice rounded hole there. Something's wrong with the story. Jim Mars, if you've read his book Inside Job, tells about interviewing a woman who was in the building in the Pentagon with her child. And of course, after the impact, the lights were out, it was smoky. She grabbed her child, and she was actually to come out through the hole. There was no fire at the hole. She was able to come out through the hole in the front of the building. And, of course, she was taken to the hospital. And according to Jim Mars, then come the men in black, the men in black are just saying that, Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking to Eric from Compton. He's asking me what hit the Pentagon, and I'm telling him, I just don't know. And I don't even like to talk about the Pentagon. I'm telling you what I know, what I've heard from other people who I believe. I was telling him that I'd actually talked to two people who told me that they saw a full-size passenger plane hit the Pentagon. Karen Lee Bixman, a good friend, talked to six people who said they saw a passenger plane hit the Pentagon. I talked to one person, and of course this is 5 years ago, who told me that they were in a building, a high-rise building not too far away, where a plane had come in, but it was painted like an American Airlines plane, but it wasn't a passenger plane. It might have been a commuter jet or something of that sort. It went right past their window, and They didn't actually see it hit the Pentagon, but it went right by their window just before the collision. So, but we do know that the FBI confiscated all the videotapes, and the one videotape that they did release, you can't see anything on it at all. So, obviously, they're concealing what happened.
Here's my question. Was there a passenger manifest?
Yes, there was. And there was a passenger manifest, and supposedly, that they have recovered DNA evidence of the people who were there. I just don't know. I think that this whole thing is designed to confuse us. So if you are confused, you're supposed to be confused. And if you understand you're supposed to be confused, you see, the only way that they could pull this thing off is to have all these conflicting stories out there. No plane hit the Pentagon. It was a cruise missile that hit the Pentagon. It was a small jet that hit the Pentagon that was radar guided. They have all of these possible stories to confuse you. And the only way that this could have been put together as it has been is, of course, as an intelligence operation. They can create holograms. In other words, you think you see it. I've been to Disneyland and seen the holograms there, and they look very real. Is that what we saw? That people saw? We do not know, but we do know one thing, and that is they're trying to confuse us. That's why I stay away completely from the Pentagon. And then, of course, the people say, well, of course, if the jet didn't hit the Pentagon, where are the people? Don't let them trap you into those questions. Stick with the things that we do know, Eric. Stick with the question of Building 7 coming down, because even this five-year study that they did on financed by the government for I don't know how many million dollars, they don't know why the Building 7 came down. Stick to the things we do know. They do not know why Building 7 came down. They do not know how the two passports could have survived. And the one thing that they do not want people to know is that on the morning of September 11th, there were military exercises that were simulating the attack, the hijackings and whether it simulated planes crashing into buildings, I don't know. There are many stories out there. For instance, there's a fellow named James Bovard who wrote a book called Pretext for War. He says that there were three military exercises that morning. Michael Rupert, in his book Crossing the Rubicon, says there were five military exercises. Webster Tarpley says there are 15. I don't know how many military exercises, but I know there were a couple, and we had a gentleman about 2 weeks ago as a guest, L.J. Chavez, who was in the military at the time, and he talked on our program. Now, he had written a letter just a few days before to a Cincinnati newspaper. Immediately, he was fired from his job, getting all sorts of death threats. I probably did the last interview with him because of the pressure that was put on him because he dared to come forward and he told me three things. Number one, he was working at the Florida NORAD headquarters or Florida military headquarters, Air Force headquarters, on the morning of September 11th. There were military exercises going on that morning that simulated the hijacking of planes. That the chain of command of aircraft intercepting hijacked planes had been changed just a few days before, within a week or two before, so that no longer could the planes take off automatically and intercept the hijacked planes. The decision somehow had to go through the Secretary of Defense. And furthermore, he saw on somebody's desk that morning a discussion of a program where they were going to hijack planes and crash them into the World Trade Center. And as a result of coming out forward and saying that, he lost his job and had death threats. So, obviously, they do not want to get the information out, but the best source of information I've come across is an article in, of all places, Vanity Fair magazine. Did you know that after American Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower, and, of course, we've seen the pictures of that, we saw it on video. Did you know that after American Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower, it kept flying, at least according to the images that were on the NORAD screens. It kept flying towards Washington, D.C. How could that possibly be? Well, maybe they just planted the images there, but there were up to 26 planes that were hijacked that they were tracking that morning. Planned confusion done intentionally. We'll be right back here with Eric. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we've got Eric, and Eric just calling and asking about what happened the morning of September 11th, saying he's confused, and I explained to him he's supposed to be confused. Everything is being done to confuse us. It is all the characteristics of an intelligence operation putting out so much confusing information that you can't put it all together. There's no way to put it together. And on the morning of the September 11th attack, according to the article in Vanity Fair magazine for September of this year, at one time they were tracking 26 hijacked planes. How could that possibly have happened? How could Flight 11 have continued flying after it had crashed into the North Tower? And of course, somebody was putting things onto the screens there just to confuse people. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295 if you have a question. Eric, did you have anything else you'd like to ask?
Just a quick comment. Talk about something being rotten in Denmark. Did you know that when those bombs went off in that London terrorist attack, the trains, they were having drills or exercises, the military, about bombs going off on trains?
Right. Isn't that amazing?
How about that for coincidence?
And isn't it amazing that that just happened? That happened just about a week before they were going to have an election over there, and had it not been for that attack, why, certainly the British Prime Minister would have lost his position. Totally. And so, you know, and the other thing is, of course, that according to Alex Jones, the explosions did not come from within the trains. They came from underneath. The metal on the floor was pushed up, not down.
Right.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks
very
much.
Good talking to you, Doc.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Okay, fine. Well, let's go to our special guest we have for this evening. For the second half hour, we have Jeff Taylor, who's a congressional candidate in the 17th District here in California. And those of you who are listening out across America are just going to have to listen, because we want to give Jeff a chance to tell you about his candidacy, why he is running, and why people should vote for him. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Well, what we're just going to, we've got about 40 seconds here to, and then, of course, all of our people will be listening. But Jeff decided that he should run for Congress. Now, there was a candidate, a Republican candidate, but he moved out of the area. He did not withdraw from the race. And he certainly, he's not campaigning. So there's no way, of course, he will have any chance of winning. And so Jeff felt called by God to actually enter this race as a write-in candidate. And I'm going to let him tell all of our listeners the reasons why he's running and what he hopes to accomplish in just a moment. When our stations return. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and for the next half hour, we're going to have with us Jeff Taylor, who, of course, is running for the congressional as a Republican, a write-in Republican candidate on the for the 17th congressional district here in the state of California. So, Jeff, why don't you tell our listeners about yourself, why you're running for office, and why people should vote for you?
I've been, why should they vote for me? I'm standing for, I feel that our moral decay of our society has been very, it's detrimental to the family, it's detrimental to the existence of our culture as we know it, if we keep going in the direction we are with the moral decay that is, imbibing our society, we're going to, God's going to stop blessing us. And I just feel very strongly that, to continue to have God's blessings, we need to continue to, look towards Him and encourage our society in whatever ways we can to, not necessarily just focus on God, but to at least have the moral values and virtues of Judeo-Christian principles.
All right, fine. And so how would you, if you were to be elected to Congress, how would you hope to be able to change the moral fabric of our society? Where would you start? If you were elected to Congress, how would you be able to do anything about what's happening as in the moral fabric of our society? Because, of course, the society is a reflection of the Christian church and the values of the church and the influence of the church, and Here we find out that, you know, the leader of the Evangelical Association, the National Evangelical Association, resigned just today because of the charges of homosexuality and purchasing amphetamine. That certainly doesn't bode very well for the moral fabric of our society. So if you were in Congress, how would you influence the moral fabric of society?
One thing, I wouldn't get involved in situations such as what you just mentioned. I feel very strongly about family values, about the family framework. I'm very concerned about education, having our children educated to the best ability possible, and whatever issues come forward as far as funding the program that President Bush put in place, No Family Left Behind, No Children Left Behind. I don't know a great deal about that at this point. It appears that it's been having some success. And
why would you say that?
Why would I say it appears to be having some success?
Mm-hmm.
In our area here, we're having, there's a lot of resistance to it. For the first thing, there's a lot of resistance as far from teachers' associations and school systems, and that's sort of an identification that when people start resisting, when they start resisting change, that change is possibly a good change.
But is it a good change or not? The thing is, what is the basic thrust of the No Child Left Behind policy?
It's increasing the test scores. Isn't it? It's about increasing test scores.
Yeah, but what are they testing for? What they're really testing for is our attitudes, the child's attitude towards internationalism and environmentalism, and their attitude towards the United Nations. And, of course, the whole idea of the No Child Left Behind is to change their attitudes, values, and beliefs, but not along Christian values. But, of course, as far as socialism and believing that government can solve all of our problems, in fact, they have textbooks that are put out by the No Child Left Behind policy, which are the antithesis of everything that I, as a Christian, and I believe you as a Christian, would believe in. But, of course, the average person has never heard what the No Child Left Behind policy is. It sounds, it's a great slogan. But if you look at the reality of it, why, it's a very, very dangerous program. But let's get on to some of the other things that you would certainly be concerned about. Education, I think we should be, but certainly our children are being indoctrinated in atheism in schools. They're being given and teaching evolution. You're not allowed to mention God or the Creator. In fact, when they teach them the Declaration of Independence, they're not allowed to talk about the fact that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. That's not even taught in our schools today.
Right, and those are certain issues that I would, those are definitely very critical issues that I would see about getting changed. There's one particular platform or issue or policy that I would plan to work diligently at, and that is the policy of separation of church and state. From my knowledge, it's not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution of the United States. It comes from letters between some of the founders or the establishers of the Declaration of Independence at the beginning and of the constitutional letters, but it's not in the Constitution. And the ideals of separation of church and state, I feel, have gone way farther because of the liberal overtones in our society. They've been implemented, and just as you said, they've essentially taken God out of the school, out of our schools, out of our public places. They're trying to take "In God We Trust" off of our currency. They're trying to take "Under God, Indivisible" out of our Pledge of Allegiance, and I would do everything I can to pull the people together to refocus back on those ideals and those issues. And those are just some of the core issues.
All right, fine. What are the other core issues that you would feel are important that would be the basis of your candidacy for the 17th congressional district?
Yeah, as far as the education is. I would emphasize increasing test scores and math, regular the three R's, the reading, writing, arithmetic test scores. I would be in support of making sure that our children are they get the highest scores possible, and they're encouraged to raise the scores there. And the way we do that is first we'd increase the established levels, and then if they're not established already, where a lot of times they're established, they're just not enforced, and then create a mechanism where teachers are honored and teachers are encouraged through grant programs or some form of reward mechanism that would encourage teachers to strive to do a better job of educating our kids.
Is there anything in the Constitution that justifies any federal involvement in local education? In other words, do you believe that the Constitution is the basis of our society? And if it is, where in the Constitution is there any justification for the Department of Education or the federal government to be involved in local education?
No, you're right. It's not there as far as I know, but it is. We are where we are, and we have to deal with. I would love to decentralize. That's not a major issue of mine, but I would love to see our government decentralized. I'd love to see us go back to just to protect and to serve as a government, that we provide, that we raise the taxes and the money necessary to limit services and to provide protection, basically an army. And that's about the extent of a national government. Then the states have to have responsibility for their issues, and the local government needs to have more responsibility. And one way to give that local responsibility right back down to not just the states and the city, but right into the hands of parents, as far as education is concerned, is to adopt a voucher system that's been, I mean, it's, the voucher system's been on our ballot out here in California. I would champion, but in the federal government, I don't know that I as a representative would have an opportunity to discuss voucher systems, not on a state level, but we could do it on a national level, possibly.
Would you want then the federal government to provide vouchers?
No. No, okay. I'm saying that we could promote it and encourage it.
As an individual, certainly I agree with you, but if, certainly as far as is not the function of the federal government to provide education for the children. I mean, after all, the only one community in the entire nation where legally they could provide the education is Washington, D.C., which is under direct congressional control,
right.
And they've got the worst educational system in the entire nation. In fact, Washington, D.C. is the murder capital of the world, and we certainly don't want to bring that same sort of thing all across the nation. So I'd want to restrict the power of the federal government as far as health and education and welfare and everything else, because it's unconstitutional. In fact, the original purpose of our Constitution was to limit the power of government over the lives of the people so they could be free. I think we've got too many people back in Washington, D.C. who want to do everything for the people.
Yes, we do. I agree with you.
Okay, fine. Well, what are some of the other major issues you'd like to bring up?
Moral education. A fiscal responsibility.
Fiscal responsibility, now that is something that I think we would all tend to agree on. But how are we going to get fiscal responsibility with a federal government that is running an $8.3 trillion national debt, you know, is spending about, you know, well over $2 trillion a year. You know, it has to borrow over $3 billion every day just to pay its bills. In other words, they're spending far more than we're taking in. How are you ever going to get it responsible?
We need to learn to control ourselves. We need to learn to control our spending, and we need to all be willing to tighten the belt and to not keep asking for what in politics is referred to as pork for our district. We need to all become more fiscally responsible. We need to programs and projects we need to have built. We need to figure out creatively some way of doing it as much as possible on our local basis. And if we, when we need assistance for road projects, for water projects, big projects like that, that support has to come from the federal government. But it should come through the taxation sources. The gas taxes. Gas taxes used to be, I think when they were first established, went to road improvements, transportation issues and things like that. But then the federal government went and started using that money for other functions. And the money that was what was originally identified for road projects and things like that, it's been diverted to other funds. And it would be nice to get back to those gas taxes go to road improvements, transportation issues, mass transportation support, if there's a viable need for mass transportation support.
Well, of course, now, one of the biggest problems facing the nation today is Social Security and Medicare. And when the, of course, baby boomers begin to retire here, actually beginning the next year or the year after that, there's not going to be enough money to actually to pay them. So then what's going to happen?
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge issue, and I am no specialist when it comes to how we're going to handle those issues. But again, I would reach out and surround myself with specialists, at least a couple key specialists that would educate me in that field so that I can make a sound judgment and the right choice.
Well, of course, the thing is that we talk about the fact that they've been stealing money basically the fund that the transportation fund that was accumulated by the gasoline tax. But they've been stealing all the money out of Social Security and Medicare for many years, so there is no fund there at all. And, of course, this is going to be a problem that I see almost no solution to. In fact, people have really looked at the national debt. It's not $8.3 trillion, as we're told. It's up around $70 trillion. All the commitments that they've made as far as federal pensions, as far as health care benefits and disability benefits and Social Security benefits, veterans benefits, and there's no way it can be paid.
That's a scary thought, isn't it?
It sure is.
Yeah.
All right, fine. Well, then, of course, what are some of the other major issues that, as you see them developing today?
I think those are the three or four key issues.
What about the war in Iraq?
Because in Iraq?
I think this is the issue, I think, that is going to be the defining issue next Tuesday. And, of course, the Republicans, many of them want to continue doing exactly what we've done in the past. Many of the Democrats want to pull out. And so if you were to be elected, where would you stand? And our guest, incidentally, is Jeff Taylor. He's running as a write-in candidate here in the 17th Congressional District. So where would you be any different than Sam Farr as far as his attitude is concerned?
I don't know Sam's stance 100%, except that I think he would just as soon see us pull out altogether and just leave the situation the way it is, possibly, if I recall correctly. But I could be wrong there on, I can't speak for him. I would definitely become very as educated as possible on the situation at hand right now there. Get more information, but I would love to see us pull out as soon as possible, but not any sooner than necessary. I was speaking to someone earlier, I'm under the impression that our government is trying to train the Iraqi forces. They're trying to help them become stabilized. People have different opinions on if we're actually trying to do that or not. I'm under the hope and aspirations that our president has a sound group of men and women that are advising him, and they are doing what they're telling us they're doing in our press, that the Iraqi forces are being trained. They've had some hiccups. They've had some bad people in the Iraqi forces. They've had to eliminate them. As the numbers are down greatly from where they were a month ago. And on top of it, the Iraqi forces are being targeted constantly, so they're being eliminated by their own people, the death squads. If we were to leave right now, if we were just to leave, get up and leave Iraq, we would create a vacuum that I don't know that we'd understand or appreciate that vacuum for years to come, and I think that would be a terrible thing to do, not just for the Iraqi people that really want to make a change, because I truly believe there's a large percentage of Iraqi people that want to make a change. They want to have freedoms the way they're starting to feel them, and we went in there, we destabilized the situation, unfortunately, and we need to see how, we need to try to restabilize it before we exit. It might be 2 years, it might be 3 years, sooner than later. I mean, as soon as possible, as far as I'm concerned.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with Jeff Taylor, who's the candidate, the Republican write-in candidate for the 17th Congressional District here in California.
Here's right here.
Well, Jeff, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Okay.
So what message would you like to leave with our listeners?
Oh, boy. Oh, I just want to leave... okay. Hold on a second real quick. I took it outside. You need to take it inside then. I'm just picking my wife back up. I'm sorry. I like to... I have a website. It's 17thcd.net. And I like to remind voters that I'm a write-in candidate. My name's not going to be on the ballot. That they need to actually write my name in. It's a blank spot at the bottom of where Sam Farr and Anthony DiMaio's name is.
All right, fine. And so you have to write Jeff Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, if you're interested in voting for Jeff. And I want to thank you so very much. But what motivated you at this late stage, because you just announced your candidacy a few weeks ago?
Right. There's two different factors. The most recent one was that Anthony DiMaio, the Republican on the ticket, didn't answer or respond to any phone calls about 2 weeks ago, and that was in the press. So that seemed like that was the last sign, the last indication that I needed to go ahead and enter the race. But just prior to that, about 2-3 weeks ago, was a huge situation with spinach and E. coli here on the Central Coast. And I come from a farming background, and I just felt, I thought it was terrible that our elected representatives did not come to the aid of the growers here locally in this valley when FDA put a moratorium or a voluntary recall on our community here. And basically it's devastated to an extent our farming community. Several millions of dollars, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars are going to be lost by the local growers because of this. They still haven't recuperated. They still haven't gotten back up to where they were levels of sales prior to this scare. And we had the safest food system in the world right here. And the problem that happened, that occurred, was that a packaging plant had an error in packaging some bad product. And that's where the problem started. That's where the problem should have ended. They should have had a recall and done that.
All right, fine. We're out of time, but thank you very much, Jeff, and the best of luck to you. I hope that everything goes well next Tuesday. Again, our guest has been Jeff Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R. You have to write his name in. God bless. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and quite frankly, we're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, trying to get people to understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And if you agree with us, if you agree that most of what's going on in the world today really doesn't make sense, if you agree that there really is some sort of a timetable that seems to be drawing us into even expanding the war in the Middle East, this is going to have disastrous consequences. And if you're concerned about what sort of a life you're going to leave your children and your grandchildren, then we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And you do that simply by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And you can join the Radio Liberty family. You can certainly subscribe to the newsletter if you'd like. Or would love to hear from you if you have any thoughts or suggestions. Then, of course, we want you to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. We'd like you to read our newsletters. They're posted at RadioLiberty.com. If you do not have access to the Internet, why, give us a call. We'd be glad to send you a free copy of perhaps my August newsletter, which will give you an idea. You see, there really are secret societies. There really are secret organizations that have an objective and a goal and a plan. The plan is for a one-world government and the destruction of Christianity. And, of course, that's what's behind taking God and prayer right out of our schools and any mention of the Creator or... And, of course, pushing evolution, and they're doing a good job. The latest polls suggest about 4.5% of school children believe in God. At one time it was much higher, but this constant program of indoctrination to destroy faith in God, because, you see, behind everything going on today is a conspiracy against God. You need, of course, to get the material that we have available through Radio Liberty. Certainly, we have a wonderful set. It's called The Founding Documents, put together by our good friend Chuck Baldwin, Dr. Chuck Baldwin, a minister in Pensacola, Florida. And it has all of the founding documents of America, from the Mayflower Compact and Washington's farewell address and the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and all of the various documents that go into the background of why America is a great and novel and a wonderful nation. It's called The Founding Documents. There are about 50 of them, and we encourage you to get that, have it on hand, and to read it and reread it to understand what a wonderful nation we have and how we're losing that nation. And then, of course, we have certainly books, Betrayed by the Bench, that takes you into the so-called wall of separation between church and state. And where in the Constitution and the Declaration it talks about God. The Declaration was simply the Articles of Incorporation for our nation, and the Constitution was drawn up to implement these ideas laid forth in the Declaration. That's why they don't like to teach the Declaration anymore, because they don't want you to understand the most important and carefully kept secret in America, and that is that our freedoms come from God. And that, as it says in the Declaration, and governments are instituted among men to preserve those rights with the consent of the governed. And, of course, that's what it's about. The purpose of government was to preserve our God-given rights. Isn't it a shame they never teach that anymore? Isn't it a shame that we have leaders who tell us that there's no difference between the Muslim faith and the Christian faith? And we all worship the same God. I don't know what God they're worshiping, but it's not the God that I worship. And that's what this is really all about. There really are people who worship the same God as the Muslims do, and they pretend to be Christians. It's about time you begin to understand the spiritual nature of the battle we're engaged in. And so get our book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or other material. Our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy that rules the world. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.
Tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation, it is, take a deep breath, Friday, the 3rd of November, 2006. And I know for a fact, ain't no bout to doubt it, that there are legions of people that were glued to their television last night, those that subscribe to or have friends that have subscribed to HBO,